Oh, I woke up this morning with my mind stayed on freedom. I woke up this morning with my mind stayed on freedom. Woke up this morning with my mind.
Hallelujah. Hallelujah. Let us join in that love and that beauty and that energy, which some would call prayer and others know as movement. Let us begin there. Gracious love, abound in our midst, in our hearts, animated in our bodies, stirred in our minds, awoken in our consciousness. Gracious love, find your way to our tongues to offer words of gratitude. Gratitude for the gift of this time. Gratitude for the air that fills our lungs and the spirit, the breath of life that moves within and amongst us. Gratitude for the travel of colleagues across the miles, across faiths, for the care of the staff of the Unitarian Universalist Association, and for all who plan and plot and promulgate justice. Let us each in our own ways rejoice for their subversion of oppression and commit to widen the fissures in the dam that justice might yet roll down like waters and righteousness like an everlasting stream. And let the people say, Amen. Amen.
Thank you, Reverend Tanner. I'm Susan Leslie, UUA Congregational Advocacy and Witness Director, and we're calling this workshop On Call for the Movement. Enter, rejoice, and come in. Are UUs prepared to contribute all we can? That's what we're going to explore here today. How many people heard Reverend Barber yesterday? All right. How many people heard Alicia Garza and Caitlin Breedlove yesterday? We've got two powerful streams right there that are pulling together, bringing in the millennials, bringing in us boomers who are not ready to go, but are ready to come, be on call for the movement. So what we want to do with this workshop today is really say, okay, we heard a lot of those big, broad concepts, but how do we really land this in our congregations? How do you get your congregation to be on call for the movement? Can't even get them to return your phone call. So... So what we're going to do is hear from clergy in North Carolina and clergy in Connecticut who've all been doing multi-faith community organizing, working with the moral movement in North Carolina, which intersects with Movement for Black Lives, in Connecticut, working with the Movement for Black Lives that has taken the wonderful Moral Monday messaging to engage people of faith. So I first just, so we'll have two panels here. We're going to go with North Carolina first, and then we'll go to Connecticut, and then we'll definitely have time for question and answer and discussion. And I just want to tell you who you're going to be hearing from, and if you guys can just wave. First of all, Robin Tanner, Reverend Robin Tanner, who just led us in prayer. She's the minister at Piedmont UU Church in Charlotte. She's a leader in the moral movement. She was tapped by Reverend Barber personally to run the voting rights campaign there this year. And she's been very active of late. North Carolina just keeps being ground zero in opposing the hate bill there. Now, she is joined by her partner, Reverend Rodney Sadler, partner in the struggle, who... who is also a leader in the Moral Monday movement. He's an associate professor at Union Presbyterian Seminary. And Rodney is also vice chair of National Justice Action Mobilization Network. It's a multiracial, multi-faith fusion network addressing climate change and chaos, poverty, and environmental racism. So they're going to tell you what fusion looks like there. And then we're going to talk to Bishop Selders and John Pollock and Reverend Jan Carlson Bull. Now, Bishop John Selders is a UCC minister, though he keeps showing up at our General Assemblies. So we may get him yet. And he is a chaplain at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. He is the Bishop Presider of Interdenominational Conference of Liberation Congregations and Ministries and Architect of Moral Monday, Connecticut. Reverend Josh Pollock is Minister at UU Society of East Hampstead. Do I have the town right?
Not even close.
What is it?
Unitarian Universalist Society East. Manchester, Connecticut.
And Josh is also the chair of the minister's anti-racism committee, and he's just been a long-term anti-racist social justice clergy activist in Unitarian Universalism. And last is Reverend Jan Carlson Bull, who is the minister at the UU Church in Meriden, Connecticut. Before that, she was in Massachusetts. Before that, she was in New York City. She has served on the Commission of Social Witness. She has been a denominational leader for justice for as long as I have known her. So please, let's welcome all our great panelists here today. And we're going to start with Reverend Robin and Reverend Rodney.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I've been trying to figure out how do I start a conversation like this. And so I guess I've been involved in issues of social justice in various ways over the years. When I was a college student at Howard, was working with the Community for Creative Nonviolence in Washington, D.C., on issues of homelessness, and began working after graduating from there with the Congress of National Black Churches, trying to bring religious communities to address social problems in communities. Went to graduate school, and while I was there, focused a lot of my attention with the IAF, Industrial Areas Foundation, and learning how to organize in local communities, helping people realize their power and things of that nature. And really, my work in North Carolina began with where I found myself locally in when I moved to Charlotte from Durham in 2002. I realized that I was a specialist in Hebrew Bible and race, and I'm now in a very largely white denomination, the Presbyterians. And so I spent the better part of my first 8 years working with helping empower local people, and then also trying to wrestle with race in these largely white southern churches, trying to figure out ways to bring people out to deal with issues of race together, and then try to bring them to tables like helping empower local people so that they could find ways to begin to work together. In part, though, my work with the Moral Monday movement grew out of a long-term relationship I had with Dr. Barber. Actually, the first conversation we had about some of his visions and plans came from, we were sitting around his table in his house, and he said, Rodney, I want to start doing some fusion work with the NAACP, and I think that we'll be able to do some significant change. That's not going to happen, Dr. Barber. That won't happen. Billy, there's no way in the world that this group, which is pretty much defunct in the U.S., is going to make any significant change. Oh, come on, Rodney. I think that we'll be able to do some significant stuff if we get the NAACP to work with some of the other groups in North Carolina. I don't think you can do it, Billy. I don't think you'll be able to do that at all. And I'm glad he proved me wrong. So in 2007, he became the state president of the NAACP. He began to do things like bringing people together out of silos and beginning to get them to start working together. His larger goal was a fusion movement with the idea of saying that there's no way that we're going to be able to have the successes that we need if we continue to work in our silos. So we need to get people that are addressing issues of climate change and healthcare issues and education issues to begin to learn how to work together, to find a movement that will become more effective and be able to actually get us victories. We increased the number of people's working on it, and we begin to work towards a better world that we're all seeking. In part, this HK on J had been a growing venture in North Carolina up until a really crucial moment. 2008, you all remember what happened. We elected Barack Obama. We had a significant voter turnout across North Carolina and across the country. 2010, we let our guard down. 2012 elections, we also let our guard down. North Carolina went from being a pretty firmly Democratic in-state state, a purple state, to becoming an incredibly red state overnight. The American Legislative Exchange Council decided that we were going to be the guinea pig for all of the worst policies that they could possibly imagine. So in the course of the first few months of 2013, we had a plan in place to refuse Medicaid expansion. That's 500,000 people that would not gain access to health care that might otherwise have it. These aren't poor, lazy people. These are working people who won't have access. We decided we'd become the first state in our nation to refuse unemployment benefits for the long-term unemployed. 170,000 people were left out in the cold by that decision. We also decided we were going to try to pioneer some charter schools by taking $100 million from our education budget and putting it into these charter schools. They eventually stopped at $10 million, but still that's money that could have gone to the public school system that didn't. And then there's this major, like Dr. Barber calls it, the monster voter disenfranchisement bill that went through, ostensibly as a voter ID law that in effect was denying people the access to the vote by limiting the early vote, getting rid of Sunday voting, which is when a lot of African Americans came out to participate in voting, by cutting down on same-day registration and out-of-district registration, and doing a number of things that would undermine not just blacks and Latinos, but also the elderly and young people, people who tend to vote for progressive issues in a more positive way. So Dr. Barber said, called one day and said, we need to come out, we need to do something, we need to figure out what we're going to do. We're going to try to do something by the end of this month. I was at a meeting with a buddy of mine, a board meeting for our seminary, and one of the local leaders with the NAACP, Jimmy Hawkins, came to me and he said, Rodney, we need to figure out a way to help out Dr. Barber. He's going to start this movement, and we need to figure out a way to help him out. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, Dr. Barber can reliably pull out black churches, but we don't know how well he'll do with white churches. Okay, so let's try to do something, Jimmy. Let's try to figure that out. I said, okay. He said, we're going to try to pull together a major movement, maybe about the second or third week that we start to protest. Let's try to bring together as many ministers as possible. How many ministers do you want to bring out, Jimmy? Oh, let's bring out 1,000. Okay, Jimmy, let's see how we can make that work. So we, Dr. Barber decided on the 29th of April 2013, to take 16 of his best friends to go in to sing and shout, to do what is constitutionally supported in our state, to inform our elected officials about how they should govern. And for singing and praying and holding up placards, he was arrested. The next week, Reverend Kojin Antambo, Dr. Peter Wary, and about 20 other people and I decided to surrender ourselves for civil disobedience as well. And this is the beginnings of what we call now the Moral Monday movement. About 4 weeks later, we were able to turn out about 750 clergy. Were you there for that? Yeah. About 750 clergy for this meeting, but in part in order to try to get people to come out in the aftermath of my arrest. Now, I want you to understand this. I'm an African-American man who was 40-something years old, who had never in life been arrested. It was my goal to get through life without ever being arrested. I don't want to have any involvement in the criminal justice system or whatever. But when I saw what was taking place in our state and I heard the call from Dr. Barber, I said that this is significant enough that it's time to change. After my arrest, and it was a traumatic experience for me for so many reasons because of what I had to give up in that regard. But I sat down and I spent the night writing a missive, my letter from a Raleigh city jail. And I basically said that it's time for us to start recognizing that we cannot accept what's going on in the state as just. As religious leaders from whatever denomination we're from, we need to stand up and step out and bear witness. So at that point in time, I wrote this letter and I sent it out on the internet, and I said, I pray to God somebody sees this, and I hope that this might inspire some people to come out and participate in this larger work.
So I arrived in North Carolina in 2010, just as Rodney describes that we were sitting down, so to speak, and then quickly entered a landscape that shifted from perhaps moderate to even progressive, leaning to a far-right turn, and what Dr. Barber calls an extremist turn, right? This isn't about Republican and Democrat. It's about extremism. And as I entered that landscape, I have to say, I arrived at the Piedmont Unitarian Universalist Church in Charlotte, North Carolina, really not seeing myself as an activist or what we might call a social justice minister. My primary experience had been in programming and pastoral care, and that's where I was going to work. That was what I saw myself doing. I had never been to a protest in my entire life.
Oh my God.
There you go. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll let the collective shock fill the room. In 2011, part of the strategy to get us to that far right turn in the state of North Carolina was something called Amendment 1, which was the marriage amendment, which was one of the most egregious amendments proposed to any constitution, which not only prohibited same-sex, same-gender marriage, but also prohibited civil unions. And so in North Carolina, we've seen this again and again, we are the place where you take the most egregious law and like spaghetti to see what will happen. You throw it against the kitchen wall, you see what sticks, and then you take it on to the next state. It stuck.
Yep.
It stuck by a large margin. Now, the one victory we did get is that they wanted to have it in the November election on the ballot, because of course, right, that would swing that vote. Instead, we got it on the May primary. We lost by about 38 points. It was devastating. All across the state of North Carolina, neighbors put up signs debating the humanity of people, neighbor against neighbor, town against town, city council against neighboring city council. So in the wake of that relative collective progressive despair, quite frankly, I had led, but by the grace of, I don't know, I answered a different email, and somebody said, will you help us with the faith effort against Amendment 1? And I said, yes. In the wake of that despair, I really was yearning personally for a movement that kept us going. We needed to do something because it was clear that Amendment 1 was the beginning of a steamroll. Unrelated, but related to the story, I got engaged to my now wife. And we planned a wonderful, not to Rodney, that would be quite shocking to Anne Marie. So we planned a beautiful wedding, and I started becoming more involved in activism, and Rodney and I were working together on things. But, you know, I was sort of on the periphery, frankly, of the NAACP's work. I heard about it. I was in Charlotte, which is about 2.5 hours from Raleigh. I'd gone to a couple of the things, but I wasn't really on the front lines. You should know during the campaign against Amendment 1, Dr. Barber barnstormed the state. He went every place that he could to speak out against that amendment. He showed up again and again and again doing multiple events across days. He left his church many a Sunday to go and speak on behalf of LGBTQ folks and human worth and dignity. So I'm on my honeymoon in Guatemala, and I'm not supposed to be checking email, but I check it. And lo and behold, I have an email from Reverend Dr. Rodney Sadler, and the email says, "I engaged in civil disobedience. I never in my life thought, as he just said, that I would find myself in a jail cell. Will you join me?" So as soon as we landed with our connection in Florida, I contacted Rodney and said, "I'll be there." And a few short days later, I found myself marching into the Capitol being arrested for trespassing in the People's House. What I have learned of this movement is that there is something deeply restorative and healing in multi-faith and multicultural movements, and that that is the only way. There is no other way to stop the steamroll.
Amen.
Yeah. I've learned also that a movement that is grounded not in... Now, we put a lot of attention on Dr. Barber, and he is a brilliant leader, and he is the first to tell us that it has to be about a movement, not a moment, and it has to be about a people, not a person. And we're clear about that, I think, in North Carolina, that it's forward together.
That one step back.
Thank you. The second piece that came out of our work is a clergy coalition in Charlotte of 75 faith leaders that are now working together for the first time. We've never had a coalition like this. In the wake of Helping Empower Local People, or HELP, that folded, Rodney and I, because of our work and the vision of fusion politics with Dr. Barber, were able to form a clergy coalition that is now working to bring the truth and reconciliation process from South Africa to Charlotte, North Carolina. We were active in the work during the trial of Officer Carrick, who shot and murdered Jonathan Farrell, an unarmed African-American man who was disoriented and seeking help after a car accident. We have been active also in the efforts against HB2 and work closely with our mayor, who has stood again and again for human rights for the LGBTQ community. And we're clear that all of it is related, and it is one movement, it is one cause, and we are one people. So thank you.
Hello, I'm John Seldes. I live in Connecticut, and it's my task to tell you the story of how Mooroma DCT got its early beginnings. I am a, let me give you just a, by way of background, I am a son of St. Louis. I grew up in a town called Kinloch. It's just west of Ferguson. So August 9th, 2014 changed my life when I got a text from a buddy. You all saw him at the rally last night, Reverend Sekou. We've known each other for a very, very long time. And my buddy, my brother, texted me, my little brother. He said, and I quote, "The crib is on fire, ... Ferguson." I text back, "What the? What? Huh?" He said, "Turn on the TV." And I saw the images like you did. Now, I don't know if people are who are here have had your hometown show up on CNN, MSNBC, national news. Mm-hmm. Here are streets I learned how to drive on, or better yet, streets I knew to avoid driving on, as you now know. What the world now knows about Ferguson, I grew up knowing. It was a sundown town. Kinloch, the town I was birthed into, is the oldest African-American town in the state of Missouri. It was formed and charted just at the end of the Civil War. What you also don't maybe haven't put together, St. Louis is the land of the Dred Scott decision. So I'm often asked what happened in St. Louis. The news, it was not an unarmed young man, teenager, shot by a white police officer. As horrible as that is, that wasn't the news, right? I'm a black preacher. You got to talk back at
yes.
me.
Yes.
That wasn't the news. The news was that young people took to Twitter and Facebook and turned up asking questions because they had had enough.
Amen.
Yep. So, of course, once Sekou called me and texted me, we had a moment, and I'm watching now with bated breath because now this is home. My mother calls. Well, baby, you coming home? My mother-in-law calls. My wife is one of 9 children. She has a brother and sister. They live in Ferguson. I got nieces and nephews that live in Ferguson. One of my nieces went to school. After school, Mike Brown had just graduated from. Another one of my nieces was a classmate of Michael Brown's mother. It's deeply personal. Deeply rooted. So, of course, in not too many days hence, I was on the line. And when I show up on the line in Ferguson, here I see my nieces and nephews. I mean, quite literally, young people whose parents I knew before they knew each other, who would say, hey, Uncle John, glad you're here, because these young people had grown up understanding that I'm a third-generation Pentecostal preacher and my work had been in the street. 20, 30 years ago, I was out there talking about HIV and AIDS and making the connection between same gender-loving people and HIV in black space, in black religious space. I was there in the front line talking about women's rights and women's justice rights, the right to do what you need to do with your own body as a woman. I was one of those African-American preachers. Thank you. That came from inside. It didn't come from your affirmation. I'm already affirmed. I knew I was doing the right thing. Thank you, though. Thank you. Thank you. So why wouldn't I be now here at home? Because it had come home. So back and forth from Connecticut to St. Louis and such and what and such and alike. I do speak black, Ebonic, African-American English, and I don't apologize for it. So I'll slip back and forth into that. Thank you very much. In the midst of this, came back home after having just come back. I was there on the ground in St. Louis when we got the non-indictment verdict for the case Eric Garner, which, if you remember, 1 week prior, it was the non-indictment verdict that came out in St. Louis. So I was in rarefied air, right? I've been sucking in rarefied air, a little tear gas, you know, got a little bit of that, and all that is and was St. Louis at that time. I come back home, and a couple of my colleagues blowing up my phone, email, text, you coming in a meeting? We need, you know, meeting, preacher's meeting, because something done happened in the world, and we got to meet on it. Any preachers, any clergy in the room, and you all know those preacher meetings?
Oh, yeah.
Them community preacher meetings, okay, I guess I got to go, because then you'll hear his story later. He called, and so then I got to go for sure then. So went to the meeting, and they started talking. Well, we need to meet with the police and maybe meet with the mayor. You know, Hartford is not Ferguson. And before they got too far down the line, I stopped it. Yeah, I'm not interested in any more doing the same old same. When has anything changed because we met with the police, we met with the powers that be, and had a conversation about it? When did it change? Somebody said that's the definition of insanity, doing the same thing and expecting something different to happen. And so I said, listen, I just came off the plane. I just got back from the front line. I'm ready to go down with the cause. I'm ready to get out in the street. It's time to get arrested. No more meetings. No more meetings. It's time to put the body and the voice on the line. And so that was the beginning. Another brother said, bro, you talking just like I feel. He was an African-American brother. And that was the beginning of what Moral Monday CT now is.
So you want me to...
I want you to follow.
Okay. All right. It's true. I did call Bishop and say, hey, we're meeting at Center Congregational Church in Hartford. And this meeting happened, and it was about going to the police and asking those questions. And what's interesting about being in what is essentially a blue state is that a lot of the people in authority are liberal, and they're with you in their language, and they often understand what you're saying when you come to them, and they say, yes, we are with you. But then when it's time to vote, or when it's time to, you know, actually take some action to reform your ways institutionally, then it doesn't come. Then the answers start getting more obscure and vague and mystical and mythological. Then suddenly what we thought, the agreement we thought we had, just disappears. I should also say we had been to rallies before, and we had done a lot of legislative advocacy, and there were a lot of interfaith partnerships already in existence. And when Bishop started talking about Moral Monday Connecticut, we did not go out looking for more clergy per se. We didn't have an interfaith conversation. This is how we're going to be together in an interfaith way. There were already people, clergy and other religious leaders, who had interfaith skills. So we didn't actually have to have that conversation, right? The first time we did an action where we actually were taking a rest, which was about a year ago in Hartford, there were UCC, UU, Baptist, Catholic, and who am I missing?
Jewish.
And we had Muslim, although a lot of the Muslims would say I'm not arrestable, so they're not out on the line with us, but certainly supporting us. And I loved the when we actually got into the police station, and we're getting ready to spend an evening in jail, and we had been separated. The men and the women had been separated at that point. But just with the identified men, there was such incredible diversity. And I looked at him and I said, "This is actually the beloved community right here."
Yeah.
The oldest person was 75. I can't remember who the youngest person was, but there were 19 or 20. There was queer and non-queer. There were it was interfaith. It was just one of those moments within the movement where we looked around and said, "Yeah, this is actually who we're trying to be." That was wonderful. I want to say this too. Before actually, there's a lot of things I want to say. I won't say them all. So Bishop said, we're not going to talk our way to social justice. We're not going to talk the system out of racism. We need to use our bodies. And this is one of the lessons I take from the Black Lives Matter movement, and certainly from Ferguson, that it's time for the creative use of our bodies in public space, using our bodies in places where our bodies are not typically showing up, like in streets, so the taking of streets. But we've done some other taking, like baseball stadiums. We did a little of that back in December, and we can tell that story if we have time. But that was new. I am a person who has always been affirmed for the use of language, for using words, and for speaking well, and for framing the issues well, and for going to testify at the legislature and speaking at the rally and preaching it. And suddenly I was in a situation where I was being asked to say nothing with my mouth except to chant,
yeah,
right, with the group. But I was being asked to say nothing with my mouth and everything with my body, and that was different. I had to work on that. That didn't just come. And Bishop knows I had to work on that. And I'm still working on it, because I've done it once, and I fully expect to do it again. And I figure we are just beginning. There's one other shout out. The Week of Holy Action. We should talk about that too.
Talk about that.
Well, I just wanted to give a shout out to Mel Hoover.
He's here.
Who's in the room?
Yeah.
Only because one of the things that I learned from Mel Hoover, who was my mentor, my internship supervisor, and the architect of the Journey Toward Wholeness initiative so many years ago, was that white congregations, historically white congregations and white clergy, need to learn how to make themselves accountable to people of color communities, people of color congregations, people of color leadership. And that was always abstract. It was always an abstract thing for a lot of us. But I feel like after years of having that language and that idea circulating around Unitarian Universalism, suddenly when Bishop John Selders says it's time to take a street, I know what it means now. This is the person to whom I'm accountable, and I need to now wrestle with this make sure I am prepared to come and show up, put my body on the line. And believe me, what we've done is easy. I know that. What we've done is easy, and it's going to get harder. But I learned that initially from Mel, and I saw Mel here, and I just wanted to say that this is not a new concept, but we're starting to implement in ways that are new, and it's really, really exciting being on call for this movement. So Jan also was on the line for the a year ago, and I wanna show you the Hartford 17 shirt. You have to come up and look at it. This was designed by one of the Hartford Catholic workers who was also arrested that day, and we all have them. And boomers. The boomers in this movement are not wondering whether they should be there. I want to also call out Sue McMillan. Sue, stand up. She was one of the City Line Dozen.
Yes.
For a while, we had a lot of boomers involved. So I just want to put that out there. Now I'm going on. You can tell I'm excited, Jan.
It's all those words are coming out.
Yeah, I know.
They are. So yeah.
The protest.
Well. You know, it was an honor to be on the line with Bishop Selders and Josh and so many others. And it wasn't just the 17 of us who got arrested. It were all the people who were. Is it not on?
It's on.
Oh, it's not. Okay, I need to talk. Can you hear me now? Okay, I'll start over. I'll try to kind of recapture my excitement. It's really an honor to be on the line and to be on call with John and with Josh and with so many others in Connecticut, and to be a part of a movement that I actually experienced first in North Carolina when you called on so many clergy and other folks and a lot of Unitarian Universalists to come to North Carolina for Moral Monday. What is it, 2014? I'm losing track. 2014?
14 was the Moral March.
The Moral March. The Moral Monday March.
February 9th.
And I remember there were 90,000 of us there and a lot of yellow shirts. A lot of yellow shirts and a lot of rainbows. And it was truly a fusion movement and a fusion moment. And it was the largest civil rights and fusion civil rights march in the South since Selma. But I remember being so PO'd at the New York Times when they put it as a little dinky article on page, I don't know, 35 or something like that. You know, they just were really lame about it. And so to be in the streets, which we were then in Raleigh and which you all have been for several years now, and to be in the streets in Hartford, which we did get a lot of publicity, but really to be on call because, as John talked about Ferguson, there is Ferguson, Missouri, and Ferguson, New York, and Ferguson, Minnesota, and Ferguson, Ohio, and there are Fergusons and Fergusons and Fergusons. And until there are no more Fergusons, we all need to be on call. We all do. How do congregations get involved? Well, I'd love to say, well, our congregation just had this awakening event and we were all kind of baptized with holy fire, but it doesn't quite work that way, as you know. But there were a few of us at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Meriden who were very much committed to anti-racism, to racial justice, etc., and were mostly white church, duh, You know, I hope that changes, but it's going to be a byproduct. It's not because we kind of preach about getting a larger box of crayons so that we'll feel a lot better. It doesn't work that way. But we began about 3 years ago with an anti-racism training, with a pretty in-depth anti-racism training. Josh, you were one of the facilitators. Walter, raise your hand. Where are you? You were the other facilitator. And we had 25 people participating, and it was so gratifying, and it was uncomfortable. And a lot of us had to move into our discomfort level, which doesn't take very long. It doesn't take very long. And we kept it up. I would like to see us keep the momentum going. I can't say that we have, and yet we are moving. We are on the move. We're not going back. We've had some common reads. Many of you are familiar with Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow. It is powerful. It's mind-changing. It's soul-transforming. Some of you remember and still use Soul Work, co-edited by the late Marjorie Bowens Wheatley, one of my dear friends and mentors, Nancy Palmer Jones, who is a UU minister still here. And then we moved into Debbie Irving's Waking Up White. Wonderful, wonderful book, especially for white folks, and it helps if a whole group is not all white. But not so that we can kind of, those of us who are white can pass the buck and have somebody else do the work for us. No, because the work of anti-racism is a white challenge, and it's a white privilege. And I always, always remember Marjorie saying at an anti-racism training years and years ago in New York City when I was a minister there, that when you let go of white privilege, there will be a cost, but you will have a far richer life. I always, always remember Marjorie saying that. It is so true. It's so true. And then we're kind of the next common read. I mean, Ta-Nehisi Coates' book, work, article that first appeared in The Atlantic. And then we're going to William Barber's The Third Reconstruction, which I finished a couple of weeks ago, I think at midnight. And after I finished it, I remember texting or emailing you, John, and saying, okay, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? That's how you feel when you get inspired by William Barber, and not just William Barber, but you, Rodney, and you, Robin, and you, John, and you, Josh, and so many others here. I see a lot of allies. I see a lot of folks who are ready for a justice of solidarity, way beyond the noblesse oblige outreach that so many congregations have adapted to. And when I think about, you know, states like North Carolina, any of our states, going from maybe blue to purple or whatever, I imagine, you know, going to, for those of us who are white, actually going into red, and it's like a big blush because we should be deeply embarrassed and shamed at the white privilege that we hold on to. And the liberalism that we kind of wear as a persona, but our souls shy back. You know, we're not quite ready to be on call. We're not quite ready to answer the call and say, yes, I will go into the streets. I will risk arrest. And frankly, when I was in that cell with some of my friends, it was kind of like a small group ministry. It was great. I could say more, but enough.
Thank you. I hope what you're all hearing is we call each other. That's how we get on call for the movement.
Amen.
Whether it's, I want you to read this book with me, whether it's, I need to talk to you about my fears of taking some direct action, whether it's, I'm ready to take direct action and challenge other people to do it with me, because we do need to be on call for the movement. I'm not saying every single time the phone rings, I can always do it, but I have learned from, I'm wearing a shirt that says Black Lives Matter Cambridge. My congregation, First Parish Cambridge UU, we've connected with Black Lives Matter Cambridge and a support group, White Accomplices. And the leader of White Accomplices came and talked to us about what does it mean to be on call for the movement. We're going to need to up it. We're going to need to do some direct action. Same thing, Blue State Cambridge, People's Republic, right? But you cannot live in Cambridge. Housing is not affordable in Cambridge. My white son has no problems going to stores, hanging out in the corner when he's with just white friends. That totally changes when he's with his black friends. So the kids led a walkout. We gave them the Standing on the Side of Love Courage Award for doing a walkout. It was the sophomores at the high school. And, sorry, my phone is buzzing. What I wanted to say about what Abe said to us is when he called us to be on call for the movement, you know, we always have like the four or five people in the congregation who say, I'm doing it, you know, I'll do direct action. And he was like, that is great and that is wonderful, but I would ask this congregation to say that you are going to form a community that supports that. And some people can do direct action. Other people are going to be making the phone calls to let people know what's going on. Other people are doing the social media. Other people are making sandwiches. Other people are getting to the people's families who may have people in jail. Other people are getting the legal support. So he's like, that's great, but I want to hear that you've had the conversation about how you're going to do this. And we've now started what are being called action contemplation circles, where churches of many faiths are coming together in the Boston area to figure out. And we don't know what we're doing next. That's part of it, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Just taking that next step. Mm. So what I want to do now is have people come up to the mic, and I want to take three questions or comments at a time, just kind of get a sense in the room of what people want to talk about and hear, and our panelists will do their best to address those. So you do need to come up to the mics because we're being recorded. And you can say your name and your congregation or whatever other identity, you know, you want.
Sure. Can you stop? I'm Reverend Deborah Hafner, President Emerita of the Religious Institute and the soon-to-be-settled minister in Reston, Virginia. And so I would like to ask my friends and colleagues up there, before you put your body on the line, did you get your board's approval? How did you go to your congregations, and what was the response? And I say that in the context of, at least for the UU ministers in the room, that one of our colleagues actually had a really big problem with her congregation after doing this. So as somebody who hasn't yet put my body on the line for this, although for other things, so I see an arrest in my future, help me not lose my job in the first year.
Come on up. We're going to take three at a time.
Get the questions before you answer.
We just want to get out the broad questions, and we'll get to them.
Okay. I was trained on a Brooklyn transformation team. Josh was one of our trainers, like 2003 or something, a while
way
ago.
Way back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm very, very, very glad to hear you talk about the beloved community, everybody together fighting for the same cause. Because I think it's very important that we join together, because I don't think we're going to get anything if we don't. And I heard all these stories about how things were cut in North Carolina, and there's a lot of poor white folks everywhere, and they were cut for the poor white folks as well. Now, because of this skin color, the police might hesitate a little more to hit me than they would hesitate to hit a black person, but they would hit me. Mm-hmm. And I would like to hear if you think that white folks are also hurt by racism.
Oh, my God, yes. Yeah.
Oh, my God, yes. Hi, Sally Riddle from a Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Atlanta. And from a logistical perspective, how is things handled when you were arrested as far as bail? And also, how were the charges handled? In other words, I've heard some instances of charges being dismissed, other instances not, and what the impact of that could be. Thanks.
So I'm going to jump to the third question. That's the one I remember. I'm not going to deal with that board approval. I'm the founding pastor of my congregation. That doesn't apply in quite the same way. We have a whole team, all right? So in order, when we call an action, because of the way we've organized, and my my organizing training has come directly through the line of Jim Lawson and the Highlander Center, all right? Kwame and Toure trained Reverend Sekou. Reverend Sekou has been my mentor in Turn Up. That's what the young people call direct action. Everybody say Turn Up. Yeah, you all, I could tell y'all ain't been around no young people in the recent. You got to say it with a particular kind of attitude. Turn up.
Yeah.
Turn up, turn up. So this is what we do. First of all, we have a whole structure of bail support, jail support. We've raised a few dollars for bail. We have a team that's going to, you know, once the arrest occur, we're on it. Who gets arrested, who, what the number to call. We have security. We have, we write names, we write numbers on our arms and all that kind of stuff. There's a whole series of things. And then we decided on every one of our actions that we were going to do jail solidarity, a bail solidarity. So, in fact, we wouldn't take bail. All right. And so that's kind of been what we've been doing. We had a little money there available, but in almost every instance, what that's meant is we sat in jail a few more minutes longer. But that, because this was the kind of thing, and we've gotten disorderly conduct as far as charges are concerned. In Connecticut, what we do, we go to community court and we do community service. Some people say, weren't you already doing that by protesting?
Yeah.
One of our folk, his latest action, the latest action we were involved in, and he got arrested, he was remanded to his own organization to do jail support at, to do, you know, community service at. So there are those opportunities to do that as well.
So very briefly on the first question, when I was called to my congregation in 2003, and they handed me a contract, which they had just got off the UUA website, and it said in there that the minister has to get permission to do anything, basically, and I just said, that's a deal breaker. I'm not going to sign that contract. You need to take that out. And what I said was, what we can put in there is, if I am asked, does this action that you're taking, these words that you're speaking, reflect the opinion of your congregation, then I could say, no, it's my own personal thing. But I'm not going to go out of my way every time I speak to say, this does not reflect the opinion. I'm just not going to do that because that undercuts my power. And I told them I didn't think they wanted their minister to have the power of the pulpit and the position undercut. But this is it's more complicated than just the contract. We also over the years created a policy, and the policy is wonderful for our congregation. It's that any committee or me as the minister are allowed to essentially do anything we want. So to be in any coalition we want, to take any stand we want, to give money to any group we want. So, and we don't have to say, well, this is the Social Justice Committee of the Unitarian Universalist Society East. We don't have to say that. If someone asks, we say it. But that gives me a lot of latitude to say, I'm going to go get arrested. Mm-hmm. And it's not like I just say, I'm going to go get arrested. I talk with the board. I say, we were talking for months and months and months, letting people know, this is coming, this is coming, this is coming, so they were ready. Now, I'll add one other thing to this, which is, that's different than hanging a Black Lives, or in our case, putting a Black Lives Matter sign out on the property. Mm-hmm. That, there's no way for someone driving by to know that that's the Social Justice Committee or the minister and not the whole congregation. That's a congregational statement. So our policy says if you're making a congregational statement, it has to come before the congregation for a vote. So we very recently, after years of work, took a vote. And I was very proud to have that vote go 98 to 4. In favor of this church supports Black Lives Matter was 98-4, and that was wonderful. Mm-hmm. And yes, white people are wounded by racism.
Oh my gosh! Yes, absolutely.
The other thing I'd add to, so when I engaged in civil disobedience, I did not identify as an activist necessarily at the time, but I had learned from Reverend David Petit that we should call it moral obedience rather than civil disobedience. And so I had that, right? Yeah, so if you see David, he is here. Right. So I had that frame, and thank goodness we gather on Mondays for Moral Monday, because I had a Sunday. So I told my folks where I was headed and why it was a call of Unitarian Universalism that had been placed upon my heart and my soul. And then I invited them to join me, but I was clear this is about how I practiced moral obedience. They were welcome to come. And I was also clear that if they just wanted to throw rocks, and if that's the place they were from, and it was about them and their own particular piece in this, or being seen, or the thrill of getting arrested, that I would ask them to please stay home the next day. So I didn't have permission from the board, but the board president and I were in conversation while I was driving there, and he was the first person I called when I got released after my wife. And it was a member of the congregation who picked me up from jail. So they were deeply involved, but I was clear about that separation, as Josh brings up. And yes, racism hurts white folks too. Any oppression is about dividing and conquering, and with racism, it's a division of the soul, including the souls of white folks.
Amen. Thank you. Just all of those questions. On the first one, permission to act. I'm a professor at a seminary. One of the first things I did, I think I made it sound as though I just sort of went to Moral Monday and decided when Barbara said to come out and get arrested, I did it. But a long time before that moment, I talked to the president of my seminary. I talked to the dean of my seminary. I said, this is where I am. This is what I feel I need to do. Will you all stand behind me? And I was impressed that they said, a conservative, Presbyterian, white seminary in the South said, we will stand behind you whatever we do, whatever you do. We will bail you out if you need us to do so. You do what you need to do to stand for justice. As we start talking about notions of jail, one of the things about Moral Monday that's been significant is that there's a very good legal team that works with us, and we've developed it over the years. A number of lawyers who will talk to people before you go in. Like, it's significant to know before you go in, do you have any outstanding warrants?
Right.
Might we want to keep you in a whole lot longer than we're going to keep. A lot of this stuff gets vetted, and there's a lot of conversation before. So it's best not to just sort of say, we're disgruntled, we're going to go out and we're going to get arrested. Do the homework beforehand. You want to make sure that you know what's going to happen in the aftermath. And people can choose to come out. You know, there's some people I know have risked arrest. Some of them have already been arrested for other issues, for moral obedience, and have chosen, in spite of that, to do it. But the point is, you want people to know up front before they go in. And that last question I really wanted to wrestle with. Of course, racism hurts white people. Dr. Barber mentioned, I think, in particular, Louisiana and Mississippi as two places where people have consistently voted against their own issues because they want to be on the white side, not the right side, of these issues. How do we think about the notion of race in ways that help us to see that this concept fundamentally undervalues human lives? And as long as we keep this notion of race in place, it's going to keep us divided along ways that hurt us all. The underdevelopment of the African American community hurts all people economically. The underdevelopment of African American political power means that progressive issues that African Americans might otherwise support don't get the votes that they would get. Does racism hurt white people? Hell yes.
I just want to say one thing. I just want to say one quick thing in response to the questions. Deborah, in response to your question also, no, I didn't ask my board. It didn't even occur to me for some reason. It probably should have. I wasn't as proactive and thoughtful as you were, Josh. But actually, no, I probably shouldn't have. I take that back. But you know that thing of ask forgiveness, not permission? Well, I wouldn't have even asked forgiveness. If that had been put to me, I would have asked my board to ask forgiveness. And yet, the congregation that I serve was totally behind us because there were two of us from the congregation who were arrested. And it was such a feeling of camaraderie and solidarity within the congregation to feel that support, because I have served a congregation where, had I stood in the middle of the street and stopped or helped stop traffic in Hartford or wherever, I would have been fired. So UU congregation, I have no doubt. So our congregations have a lot of work to do, including mine.
Reverend Walter LaFleur, given that the world doesn't always look the same from a white perspective as from the perspective of people of color, particularly ministers of color, I'm wondering if you could speak to why some ministers of color would choose not to put themselves on the front line and particularly get arrested.
Terry Ellen, consulting out in Cumberland, Maryland. I just wanted to ask you more about your jail not bail decision and how that was arrived, because that really does up the ante significantly. I'm down in D.C., and D.C. it's a well-oiled machine, but out in Cumberland, Maryland, the sheriff was not amused and wanted to put like a three-year, and what I'm wondering about is wanted to put a three-year sort of probation-type thing on you, or really heavy community service to get out of that as a way to silence people. Just more about that.
Hi, I'm Bruce Field from Attleboro, Massachusetts. I'm on the Social Concerns Committee at my church, and we're working at talking with the police department and the mayor at this point. Okay, stop laughing, please. But no, I need to let you know that so I get a little bit of feedback on that if you have time to do that. We're at the point where we're starting to ask about statistics, and they're saying, "What do you talk?" Wait, and you know, we're getting a little bit of pushback.
They lie.
So now, okay. Mm-hmm. And we're it's a smaller town. I've lived in Hartford. I know. But anyway, so now what I ask you is, your experience in terms of, you know, what happens when you go from the sitting down and talking nicely to asking tougher questions and what that's about. But also, my question to you is, if you do go out and go on the streets and make the protests and get the headlines and get arrested and all that kind of stuff, what's your feeling about, does that change some things? Where does it fit on the continuum of actually making things better or not? If you can talk about that, I think that'd be great. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Oh, all right. I'll address that one and try to get yours in, Walter, as well. Here's the quick response. The police don't give you the real story. If those of you who were at a session a few days ago, with the Adam and Al, wonderful. What I found to be the truth, when you're in conversation with the police, they stonewall you. They won't quite give you, they got little stuff they give you, you know, that's public record. But the real stuff, you never know because they won't tell you. They won't share. They lie. They grin. They smooze. And they have in Hartford, and in Bridgeport and in New Haven. I can talk about those three towns in Connecticut. They have a staff who are media savvy trained. We're doing an action in front of HPD, Hartford Public Police Department, and the lieutenant commander, deputy chief, is tweeting, "This is how we're keeping you citizens of Hartford safe." While he's with a picture of us protesting out in front of they used us as their own propaganda, if you will. All right. So my experience is the folk that they invite in to meet with them, they give them the song and dance, and then those clergy and other leaders then are sent back out to tell their story and their version of the story to quell the natives. And I decided, at least for me, that I wasn't going to be involved in it. Finally, that police chief wanted to meet with me, so he huddled me in the corner at a meeting, said, "Reverend Bishop, we you know, can we meet with coffee? I know you like coffee. We meet you at your favorite place." So I said to him, "I'll meet with you, chief, and I'll meet with you and talk to you one-on-one, but it'll be in public. It'll be in the presence of a whole bunch of other people. And you and I can have the conversation direct one-on-one, but it'll be in public, not behind closed doors. You won't be able to give that same story And then they say, well, you met with the police chief back behind the doors, and now, you know, you're in the family or in the fold, if you will. I won't do that any longer. Here's, you asked the question about, does it make a difference? Here's my response to this. More Monday CT, you know what I'm getting ready to say. Turn up creates the political space for community and social transformation to occur. Let me repeat it again to you. Turn up. Turn up creates the political space for community and social transformation to occur. We watched it. I get this directly from Dr. King's letter from a Birmingham jail. It is what you do in the turn up. You apply pressure so that others can be in the space, wherever that space is, that's political space, and that's where the negotiating and the dealing happens. We have somehow forgotten that that's what taking the street is about. It's about asking the question publicly, so that then in the places and spaces where decisions are made, you got ammunition. A quick story: we turned up from the Capitol, state Capitol, to the city hall during our Holy Week of Action. We called a week of Holy Action in Connecticut, More Monday CT. You want to know about that? You check our website, moremondayct.wordpress.com, and check it all out. But we call we march from the state house where we had about 1,000 people, give or take a few hundred. About 1,000, give or take a few hundred. And then we walked over to City Hall. City Hall, our mayor had decided he was going to pull a Flint. He had a bill on the at the Capitol to take the power of writing checks, the financial power of the city council, away from Hartford City Council to an appointed governor-appointed committee or group, because we... his first 90 days of office, all right? This is the power play he was going. This is a power grab to take what the city councils normally do. What's the biggest part of their work? Writing the checks, figuring out the budgets, right? He wanted to take that away from our just newly elected new city council. So what did we do the night that they were discussing and going to vote on a resolution to support that effort? We turned up on their behinds, all right? And I like what the media reported. Hundreds descended. It wasn't 100. It was about 50-60 of us. But hundreds descended.
It's really loud.
It was really loud. We were chanting and carrying on. And by the time we got to City Hall, here's the end all. I got a call from the minority leader of City Council the following morning. And she said, Bishop, thank you. Because what happened is that we knew going in we had 4 votes of the 9 votes to try to kill this, you know, try to vote no on this resolution to support this state bill. When you all turned up like you did, in fact, we couldn't have planned it more perfectly, the mayor was talking at the mic as we were coming in. And so I see videotape now of him getting the close to the mic. Can you hear me? And they couldn't hear. We were so disruptive. We turned up on their behind so much, so fiercely, that at the end of the night, the vote went 8-1 to kill that bill. Let me say you one more time. Turn up creates the political space for social and community transformation to occur.
Yes. And
it does.
No. No.
She asked if the police chief has met in public yet. Yeah. Rodney, would you address Reverend LaFleur's question about what if ministers of color?
Yes. Yeah. And thank you. I was waiting to look at that question, too, because I think that that's a crucial question and one that I scratch my head about all the time. I think about 3 answers that just jumped to the top of my mind. And the first is that many of us think that the victories were won. We did that. We did that back in the 60s. We did that back in the 70s. We don't have to do that anymore. So there are many people who say we won those victories. We shouldn't have to do them again. Another major issue is in North Carolina in particular, this has been significant. Dr. Barber, because of what Robin's already said, took a significant stance against Amendment 1. And aligned himself with the rights of all people. Some African-American ministers in the state of North Carolina took that as, you have become immoral. You have sold yourself out. you no longer have moral authority, which I think is the totally opposite of what he actually did. But in all honesty, that continues to be an issue today. We had a group that responded recently, a group of nine ministers that came out to oppose our efforts against Hate Bill 2 in North Carolina, suggesting that it is moral to put Hate Bill 2 in place. So we have to wrestle with these issues and find ways to bring these different communities together. I'm convinced now that literally this is a decision of the right. We only talk about gay issues every 4 years. You ever notice that? It's election year issue. And we only talk about abortion every 4 years. Why is that? It's an election year issue. And the thing that gets me about these two issues is this. If you notice, what is one thing that a straight white male can't be? Gay, can't get an abortion. These are the things God hates most. Isn't it amazing? You ever notice that?
No.
I wonder if there's something to this. So I think that there's a lot that goes on. We are divided. We are often, these issues are often raised as wedge issues to divide us one from the other and to destroy the potential for fusion politics that might have the potential for change. The last thing I want to say is why a lot of clergy don't show up, black and white, is because I think our theologies are restrictive, and far too often they lead us to believe that our work is primarily within the four walls of the sanctuary. We have to get beyond what Dr. King called the anesthetizing silence of stained glass windows. We have to be able to get back into the streets again and to realize. I'm a Christian, and I will affirm my Christian conviction and say, it's time for us, and I'll use the Christian context, as Christian ministers, to not just take Jesus and put him in the sanctuary, but take him out and introduce him to the world.
We have one more comment? Yeah, two? Okay. We're going to have to wrap up, so it's going to be quick, but I want to let you guys talk.
My question, Lee Blumel, North Andover, Mass. My question was related to what you just said. I'm just wondering, and I can do this after, if anyone has examples of successfully creating fusion coalitions when GBLTQ issues are a stumbling block to that, and in my town, it's the Latino evangelical community that there was just so much hurt after Orlando with the GBLT community trying to have a vigil together. So that's my question.
That's
and that's
really
for the whole
question.
Room, if anyone has examples.
Yeah.
All right. I'm Sarah Gush. I'm actually from Chapel Hill, so right around the corner. But my question is that you guys have all kind of touched on this, but how do we and how have you in your congregations gotten young people who are already so busy? I work three jobs trying to balance my life and start my future and finish school and have a family. How do you get young people and encourage young people, right, our young adult generation, out and on call for the movement? And how do you successfully do that?
Hello. I've seen something on some blogs online about registering your name as Doe if you don't want to give out your name when you get arrested, and I wanted to know your perspectives on that. What role doing that plays, and what should a first-time, I guess, arrestee expect during and after something like that, and does Doe...
Okay, so listen, we have to end, but the reason I wanted to hear the questions is because I started this off saying we got to talk to each other. People say, I want action, I don't want talk. We do need to talk. It's the conversations that we need to have. So I want to point out some people in this room. Caitlin Breedlove, Standing on the Side of Love campaign director, please stand up. Linda Olson Peebles, President of UU Ministers Association and community organizer extraordinaire. Chris Crass, he's here with his latest book. We need a day at least to have this conversation, but we got to close because that's the rule of the General Assembly. But I want to thank Josh. I want to thank the Bishop, Robin, Rodney, and Jan for sharing just some of your experience And I got sign-up sheets there. I really want you to sign up. I'm not going to send you something you don't want. This is about building this movement. We got to connect. You know, send the questions. We're going to figure out how to do this together. Thank you so much for being here.